Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Before we get to it, a word about our sponsor. The University of Dallas is a premier Catholic liberal arts institution, renowned for its rigorous core curriculum and thriving graduate programs. Careers in ministry, teaching, business, humanities, and science are formed here. With campuses in Texas and Rome, Italy, students begin their pursuit of a life well lived. We have two alums of Dallas here at First Things on staff, and they are both superb. For more information on the University of Dallas, visit udallas.edu. That's udallas.edu. Adam Bly is with us today. He is the author of Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms, and also The Catholic Guide to Miracles, and now a new book, The Exorcism Files. True Stories of Demonic Possession. That's our topic today. Welcome, Mr. Bly.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
So when we look at the issue of exorcism, when that comes up, what is the general, I don't know how to put this. What's the popular impression of exorcisms out there beyond the Catholic world, let's say?
Well, I think even within the Catholic world, there's a lot of misconceptions because people largely, and it's no fault, they largely just have the movies to go by. And so a lot of people have a lot of presumptions about exorcism ministry that are based in the films, and they don't even know to question that presumption, because if it's on a screen, it's true. That's kind of the assumption built into our society. Films have a large impact on society and the zeitgeist and people's thinking and understanding of terms. And so I think the common idea is that, number one, it's a dramatic prayer that's a few minutes long, and then the case is over. That's not true. None of that's true. Secondly, that it's special people. You know, a priest with a special gift is the kind that is chosen to do this, and that's not true either. Every priest is an exorcist. They just don't have permission to do solemn exorcisms. So that's another error that Hollywood creates in the process of trying to create a hero figure in the film.
How did you get involved in this world of demons?
Well, it's a long story, but it started in adult clinical psychology and brainwave research. So I was working towards a PhD in adult clinical psychology, working in an EEG lab, which is essentially brainwave analysis, so kind of advanced signal processing of brainwaves to infer structure and function of the brain. And I had done my master's on hypnosis and changes in consciousness and how that's reflected and how the brain moves information around, which you can measure. You could argue that you could measure and interpret from the brainwaves. So I knew that a hypnotizable person can have a false experience on command. And this is a this is a healthy, non-mentally ill undergraduate student who, by definition, they're in college, they're an undergraduate student, they're reasonably bright, they don't have mental illness, there's no medical problem, there's no tumor, there's no drugs involved, and yet they can hallucinate on command under hypnosis if they're hypnotizable. So I think this led to a reasonable question, which was, are any of these claims of strange spiritual experiences spiritual realities, or are they just an artifact of the brain? And at that time, the paranormal TV craze was just starting. It hadn't become popular or mainstream yet, but that question was starting to enter the kind of common discourse. And that led to wanting to go out and interview people for myself, because I had been trained in diagnosis in terms of mental illness, and I had worked in the training clinic for some time and, you know, had some experience talking with people. And so I started going out and chatting with people that had these claims of these experiences, and pretty quickly bumped into a person that I, looking back on it, I'm pretty confident they were possessed. And that was an interesting encounter, and that led to seeking out specialist clergy that knew more about this stuff once I realized it was real. And the snowball has been rolling down the hill ever since.
And let's just be clear, you didn't start out looking. You were a good scientific researcher, properly skeptical, and, you know, the good scientific method way. You weren't seeking out the evidence.
No. My question was for myself is, you know, Occam's razor, you know, says from a philosophy of science perspective, the simplest explanation is almost certainly going to be the correct one. And this is an error that I continue to see to this day. Humans have a tendency to leap from the evidence to the spiritual hypothesis without ever ruling out the mundane. And I think there's some bias built into us where we're hungry for spiritual experiences or spiritual realities, but it's a real problem because you can skip the medical, the mundane hypotheses, jump to the spiritual, and miss out on treating something that's important. So, you know, at the time, I wasn't jumping to the spiritual hypothesis, and I wasn't eager for that to be true. I was trained enough in clinical work, and I had seen through hypnosis, the brain's capable of giving you false experiences that are completely real to you. And so that seemed the more likely explanation, given what I had seen for myself and what, you know, the science of psychology had observed and documented in the journals.
And generally speaking, the church shares that skeptical attitude toward claims of possession, correct? I mean, they put a case through a pretty detailed psychological analysis first.
Yeah, so the church figured out centuries ago that most of these requests for exorcisms or complaints of demonic problems, the church figured out, at least in the Middle Ages, probably earlier, that it's usually mental illness, it's usually a medical problem, or it's somebody seeking attention and they're just lying. So the church doesn't just do exorcisms because a person says, I think I need this, or even demands it. The church, there's basically two big hoops to jump through. The first is you need an outside psychological or psychiatric evaluation from somebody qualified. So that person also needs to be told what the symptoms are. And the reason I say that is a lot of people will say, well, here's my report, you know, I don't have any mental illness, but they never told the psychiatrist that they're hearing voices that are claiming to be the devil or something like that. And I ask them, like, well, how can they evaluate these symptoms to see if there's something causing it if you never tell them about the symptoms? And they'll often say, well, if I told them that, they would lock me up in the hospital. So of course I didn't tell them that. So you need to get an actual evaluation of the symptoms that are leading to your conclusion that this is demonic in order to try to rule out those things. The second big hoop after that is we, the church, need to see the signs of possession. It's not you telling me, oh, well, I got that book and I experienced all four of those things, and so you need to do this for me. The church, you know, needs to observe that. And then after you've gone through that process, you then go to the bishop and say, you know, here's the outside psychiatric or psychological or medical evaluation. They're saying this person's sane. They don't see an explanation for these symptoms. And here's what we observed in the diagnostic prayer sessions. You know, we think it rises to the level, but it's up to the bishop to decide. And then if he says okay, then you can start the exorcism. And there are, you know, there are times that it takes weeks or months for that process.
Yeah. Lots of fakes, as you point out in the book, such as the Fox sisters. Who were they?
Yeah, so the Fox sisters were kind of the start of the spiritualist movement in the West. These were two sisters in upstate New York who were relatively young, who basically, with an apple tied to a string, simulated ghosts knocking on the wall in their house as a game to con their mother, and led to, then they got some attention for this, and that led to getting a little more elaborate in their, you know, deception and conning a lot of other people. And that led to just an amazing, at least in the West, here and in Europe, wave of interest in spiritualism, of directly communicating with spirits, thinking that all of this was real. And it was only later in life. Now, they made plenty of money. They made a career out of this. And it was later in life that one of them got guilty and kind of fessed up and said publicly that this had all been a hoax. But then the money dried up, and so they recanted that and tried to start making money with it again. But, you know, the Fox sisters, that was a big, it was right at the turn of the century that was really getting big. And then World War I came, and a lot of people lost their loved ones, you know, their children, their brothers, fathers in some cases. And so there was a lot of people looking for a final, I love you, some solace that the person is still there somewhere. And so spiritualism, as it still does today, psychics prey on people that are grieving and try to ask them for money to contact their dead loved ones, which is, you know, disturbing on a number of levels. So the wars really fueled it. So even though the Fox sisters kind of fessed up that it was a hoax, the horse was out of the stable, so to speak, and it was running.
Yeah. You run through a lot of cases, some brief, some longer. The house in Maine. Mm-hmm. You can't be more specific. There's the house in Maine. You came across three mounds of dirt mm-hmm. that looked like small graves. What was going on there?
Yeah, so this was a case that I had visited along with a friend who works up in New England in this area. And the daughter called us in with complaints of manifestations in the house. And we went there to try to evaluate things. And her mother, who was living with them, lived in the home. And then her three little girls also lived in the home. So total five people, all women, three generations of the family. And there had been a kind of assumption that it was the daughter that was troubled. She had had somewhat of a little bit of a rough background, had had a brush with occult stuff and black magic, seemed to be the center of things. And while we were praying for her, in the midst of praying for her, and really nothing was happening in terms of like a diagnostic prayer to see if there was anything there that was demonic, we heard this fairly gruff voice behind us saying, "Get out of my house." And I turned around, and the grandmother was standing there in a purple kind of what you would kind of a classic witch's robe, with a steel ball in one hand and a pry bar in another. And she looked very strange, her facial expression. And so after that kind of confrontation, you know, nobody hit anybody, but she basically dropped those things and ran upstairs, locked herself in the room, and proceeded to try to burn the house down, which she had done in the past, I guess. This was a big old house up in New England. So had to call for emergency services, and they came and I guess got that door open and loaded her into an ambulance to take her to the hospital for presumably a psychiatric evaluation. And in the midst of investigating all of this, she had dug three graves representing the three granddaughters in the backyard under this big kind of weeping willow tree. And had, while she was upstairs locked in the room, she had laid out pictures of the three little girls on the floor. And there was like what might have been some kind of magic accoutrements and oils and things like that spread around that she was maybe trying to do what she thought was a spell. Don't know what she was doing exactly, but those were basically simulated graves, poke sticks in them. There was nothing in them, but so very disturbed grandmother. And yeah.
But just now, would you, when you turned around and heard that voice and saw her, mm-hmm. this is more than just mental illness? Was that your conviction? No.
No, not necessarily, because, I mean, people can fake, right? Unless something, and people can be deluded. They can have a delusion. So, sure, it's weird that we had met her and she was pleasant before. She wasn't opposed to the visit to the home or anything like that. It was odd that she was speaking in a different voice and dressed that way and had what looked like weapons, but that doesn't mean she's possessed. She could just be crazy. Yeah. So what made her flee is she kept looking at the crucifix and looking back at me and looking at the crucifix I was holding, looking back, and then dropped things and ran out of the room. that doesn't mean she's possessed. You know, the classic signs of possession are knowledge of all languages, detecting the holy when it's not obvious. So if I hold a crucifix over you and you recoil, well, it's obvious you're supposed to. But if I don't tell you that a relic of somebody is taped under the chair that you were directed to sit in when you came in and you jump off the chair, that's not obvious. You see the difference.
And you've seen that before.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's many versions of this, like have 10 identical bottles of water, one of which was blessed before the person arrived. They're not told which one it is. And every single time they can pick out that one and say, that one bothers me. Hmm. And that's in the human state. That's not the demon talking. So knowledge of all languages, schizophrenia doesn't make you suddenly fluent in ancient languages, right? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't. Knowing secret things about people. So knowing your dirty laundry that nobody else knows, either nobody else was there or whoever else was there has passed on. This person doesn't know you. They have no way of knowing your secret business, but they're now recounting the most shameful things you've done to everybody in the room. Mental illness doesn't give you that ability. And I don't mean vaguely like, you know, oh, you did something bad. I mean very specific. Detecting the holy, as we mentioned, and then strength beyond their condition in life. And that's the weakest of the signs, in my opinion, because I've done a lot of work in forensic psychology in the prisons. And I've seen people exhibit strength that was way beyond what you would think a human could do when they're in a psychotic state. Now, the difference with the possessed is they never get tired. So the crazy person has a burst of adrenaline and the body can do that for a very brief period of time. The possessed person, 3 hours later, they're still as strong as they were, throwing men around the room. And when the person comes out of it afterwards, they feel completely normal. Their muscles aren't sore and shaking. They don't feel, you know, like they need to sleep for 12 hours. They just feel normal. So those are the four signs: languages, knowing secret things, detecting the holy when it's not obvious, and strength that's just unbelievable.
Yeah. And you've attended some of the paranormal gatherings. You taught, and after the paranormal craze, how did that go? What do you see there in those people?
Well,
you might mention Molly and her divining rods that episode. Anyway,
yeah, you know, it's a world of people that they're very interested in a shortcut to the supernatural. That's easy, that also feeds the ego. So the sense that this is an easy way to have a spiritual experience of the supernatural, and I'm in charge of it, and I'm part of it, which kind of feeds the ego. So it's very attractive in that sense. And then beyond that, it holds out the promise of knowledge about the afterlife, knowledge of secret things, or comfort. So basically comfort, information, power in some form. It holds those things out to the person. Basically, you know, if I can get in touch with grandpa, I can be comforted. You know, maybe I can get in touch with the famous bank robber so-and-so and he'll tell me where he buried his loot. okay. You know, that's a silly example, but sometimes people go for very concrete outcomes. And then a big one in that world is, if I get lucky, I'll get a TV show and get some attention for this, just like the Fox sisters.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one, you note a little later on something of an irony in that there are cases where simple curiosity about the paranormal, which may be for entirely selfish reasons or financial reasons, can actually make people vulnerable to genuine possession.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually say to everyone, stay away. There is no, this curiosity of yours, the entertainment factor, it's not harmless. You've seen this happen?
Yeah. I know most of the people from the first number of years of the paranormal craze in terms of TV celebrities. I either knew them at the time or knew about them through other people in terms of their personal lives. And most of them had dramatic and very negative kind of fallout in their lives. Now, some of that, of course, could just be the drama of the kind of person that would seek to be on a reality TV show. But a lot of it was what sounded like spiritual oppression or demonic infestation of their homes. ugly manifestations, but Hollywood's not interested in telling you that part of the story because that's not attractive for viewers and advertisers. And so they make it seem like it's harmless, but it's not, because you're literally inviting a spirit into a relationship with you, but you don't know who it is. So it'd be like picking up your phone, dialing a random number, and giving the person your social security number when they pick up the phone. You have no idea who you're giving your information to, or the ability to connect to. And there's a reason, from a Christian perspective, that the Bible warns so strongly against playing around with spirits, because it's dangerous. Necromancy is forbidden, and that is literally what paranormal investigating is, calling up the dead to talk to them. That is exactly explicitly what they say. Speak into this recorder. I want to have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
Or signal me in some way that will give your answers. The reason it's forbidden is because there's a lot of deceptive spirits out there that will pretend to be your grandfather or whatever, your guardian angel or your totem animal, whatever's going to make you drop your guard. They're out there. So you'd best just to leave the door closed.
Yeah. I'm not sure you want to go into this or not. It's a disturbing story, but you bring it up in the book. You got an ominous phone call from in 2005 or six, I can't remember, from Mark Constantino. Do you want to recount what happened there? The fuller story?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a very sad, very real situation. Three people ended up dead. So I knew Mark and Debbie for a few years before that. They were probably the most famous, at the time, the most famous EVP experts in the paranormal world. And that's electronic that's electronic voice phenomenon, which is basically you turn a recorder on, a digital recorder, like a handheld that you might use to record, a doctor might use to record some notes after a consultation or something like that. You ask a question and then you wait in silence for, say, 5 or 10 seconds, probably less than that. And then you ask your next question. And then upon playback, you hear yourself asking the question, but then you hear an answer. And you knew nobody was speaking in the room at the time. And that's presumed to be a ghost speaking. Now, usually it's very faint, might be garbled, might be little more sound than the background hiss if you turn it way up and you just hear kind of the background noise in the recorder. But so Mark and Debbie were probably the biggest experts on electronic voice phenomenon in terms of being asked to come on paranormal TV shows and speak at conferences and all of that. So I had gone out to Reno, where they lived, and visited them and tried to pray for the home, because their house was very active with spiritual problems. They had spiritual problems that I don't want to get into. But I had gone and visited them and prayed with them and tried to advise them to stop, because they were doing this stuff in their own private home. They were doing these electronic recordings. So anyway, I hadn't heard from them for probably 6 months, maybe a year. And I was at work one morning at the diocese and the phone rang really early, and it was Mark, and I was surprised to hear from him. And he sounded upset, like maybe he was maybe he was crying. He said, "You're going to hear some things about me soon. Don't judge me until everything comes out." And then he said, "I guess the thing in the house is going to get what it wants." And he hung up. And, you know, looking back on it, I wish I had done more or thought, you know, I had no idea what he was referring to. I had no idea that he would be contemplating killing people or himself. So, but of course, you know, you go over those things and you feel bad.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
You should have picked up on it. So anyway, it was either later that day or it was early the next morning. I don't remember now. It's been so many years. In a standoff with the police, he killed his wife, Debbie, killed her boyfriend. They were in the process of being separated. They'd been married for a long time. Killed her, killed her boyfriend, and then killed himself after a brief time in a standoff with police. And I don't know much more about it after that. I know there was a lot of sad difficulty with the family, of course, and it drew a lot of attention. But the only reason I shared that story is to point out one example of, you know, and by the way, I'd been present and seen them do this stuff. There was something talking through the recorders when they would do it. But the striking thing about it was that everywhere they went, instead of the supposed ghost in the house that they were in, it was always the same voice, and it was always saying that it wanted to kill Debbie. And it hated her. And everybody knew that. Everybody in the paranormal community knew, like, everywhere they went was basically the same thing, saying foul language about Debbie. I'm not saying that Mark was producing it. I don't think he was. I watched in order to try to debunk this. Are they faking this stuff? So anyway, I shared it because it's an example of somebody right before committing a murder-suicide crediting the voices coming over these recorders as it's going to get what it wants.
You talk a lot about going into rooms and houses, independently of the people, right? And blessing those spaces. So much of the exorcism has to account for the space in which this takes place. It can come out of the house, the rooms.
Well, what are you asking?
Well, just that demons can inhabit a dwelling. Mm-hmm. These are, and so anyone entering that dwelling would be vulnerable?
To an extent. So to be more proper about it, they can get permission to do extraordinary things in a dwelling. So we know that their ordinary job is to tempt us. In that sense, they can go anywhere because it's their job to tempt human beings. And they're allowed by God to do that function. And so you shouldn't think of it like, oh, they're not in this house because there's not stuff flying around and crazy things going on. They are there because they're following people around tempting them. Now, it's when they get permission from God to do something extraordinary, like throw stuff around, push somebody down the stairs, scratch people with real physical scratches, on the typical things with demonic infestations. Once they get that permission from somebody who has authority over the home, that's when you'll see what would be called a demonic infestation. And when the exorcism is done over the home, it is telling it to leave and basically depart, get out of here. Really, the more subtle understanding of what that means is stop doing these extraordinary things here. It's not that they won't be able to enter that house ever again, but they won't be able to do these extraordinary things there.
Last question, Adam. Have you ever felt yourself seriously in harm's way?
I mean, a person tried to lure me to their home in order to harm me one time, but I guess just in terms of common sense, I didn't fall for it and called them on it and didn't go. I think I would have been in harm's way if I had gone. They were possessed, and the demon started speaking through them over the phone after I made it clear I wasn't going to fall for it. The thing about the demonic is, if you're going to be involved in this work, you need to trust God completely. You basically need to push all your chips in and say, okay, God, I give you my life. It was his anyway. I didn't make myself. I give you everything, and I trust you. And when you go in those situations, you need to trust God. And God is the only reason they're not able to physically harm us or, you know, do terrible things. I have seen at least one situation where somebody went in that situation for selfish reasons with mortal sin on them that was unconfessed. And they just went there because they wanted to see something. That person went crazy and they were institutionalized. I've seen another case where there was a person present that probably shouldn't have been there. And the possessed person in the demonic state locked eyes with them and they stopped breathing. They couldn't move. They were paralyzed. They were speaking through clenched teeth and they stopped breathing and it was only by breaking the gaze and covering the eyes of the possessed person that they were able to start breathing again. So, I mean, there's potential real danger if you're entering into this for the wrong reasons. If you're doing it because God has sent you into these situations, you're fine. You don't have anything to be afraid of. You might get bruised and scratched up and bumped around a little bit, but you're going to be fine and you're going to keep doing it year after year. But it's those two things. God has to have asked you to be there, and you really have to trust him.
The book is The Exorcism Files, True Stories of Demonic Possession. Adam Bly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. God bless you.